In looking at this second subject in the church history thing, I draw your attention to the pretty well-known passage in Matthew 16, where the Lord spoke to Peter about the church and the other disciples and what he hoped for it. It's a passage in Matthew 16 that starts at verse 13. I'd like to read it for you in a background setting. Matthew 16, verse 13. When Jesus came into the coast of Caesarea Philippi, he asked his disciples, saying, "Who do men say that I, the Son of Man, am?" And some said, "Some say thou art John the Baptist, some Elias, others Jeremias, or one of the prophets." He saith unto them, "But whom say ye that I am?" And Simon Peter answered and said, "Thou art the Christ, the Son of the living God." Jesus answered and said unto him, "Blessed art thou, Simon Bar-Jonah, for flesh and blood hath not revealed it unto thee, but my Father which is in heaven. And I say also unto thee that thou art Peter, upon this rock I will build my church, and the gates of hell shall not prevail against it. I will give thee the keys of the kingdom of heaven. Whatsoever thou shalt bind on earth shall be bound in heaven. Whatsoever thou shalt loose on earth shall be loosed in heaven." And he charged he his disciples that they should tell no man that he was Jesus the Christ. Well, there's a lot in that chapter and those verses I'm not going to discuss. I am going to emphasize this truth. The Lord said, "I will build my church, and the gates of hell won't stand against it." And we believe that. But when it comes down to the local individual assembly, the promise is a little different one. The church that the Lord will build is that company of people that will praise him forever in glory and encompasses believers from all parts of the universe and all places, and he will not fail in that purpose. But local churches often fail, often die, often go out of existence. Sometimes they even take up a message which is foreign to the gospel and become more of a handicap to the truth than a help to the truth. So we believe the promise of the Lord that the gates of hell will not prevail against what he's doing and drawing out a people for himself and for God. We believe that. But on the local level, we say, "Lord, help us to be faithful with our company that we will prosper with that party." There's no room for nonchalance at the local church level. No room for mediocrity. No room for taking it for granted. I'm a professor. So I should not be saying things like that to you who are working. You'll just have to understand that every professor imagines himself to be something that he's really not. And that's sometimes the way you come across, too. Well, I'm not trying to say, here's your job or here's my job. What I am trying to say is that at any age in church history, nonchalance, taking it for granted, obsession with wrong things, have been the ruin of individual testimonies and often of great movements for God. Now, this second period of church history is a big one. I've taken it from roughly about 400 AD, just as a nice fat date, up to the time of the Reformation. I've called it the period of time when the church became more occupied with worldly things. It is a vast period, not nearly so healthy as the first, because by now the church is already beginning to feel the effect of schisms and developments. The first Christian schism of any consequence, by Christian I mean one in which believers with some issue separated. Now, the first one of any consequence came about 250 A.D. It's known as the Novatian Schism and was not really a giant one except in a few limited places. It came over certain purity problems in the church. The second one of any consequence came about 313 A.D. with the Donatist Schism. I didn't bother to mention these things in my notes. I haven't started the notes yet. I'm just telling you what. Guys are always filling stuff in. The Donatist Schism. The third large schism came about 454 after the Council of Chalcedon, when a large number of Eastern churches departed. And really from there on, that's 454, but from there on, you get an increased splintering of this oneness body. And eventually there will be a great division east and west and many other divisions too. Some good, some bad. But what I'm saying is that this age, this medieval age, is the age where the church becomes overwhelmingly preoccupied with worldly things, not necessarily wicked in themselves. What's wrong with a nice building? What's wrong with a golden top on it? What's wrong with having neat grass in the front yard? Not necessarily wrong in themselves. But things that when they become the dominant thrust in what the church is doing, displace the spiritual life and vitality of the community. If you're more worried about your rug than you are about the little kids that are sitting on it, then you've lost your sense of values. And we'll meddle no further there, although I may come back with a couple of grisly stories later on. A few minutes of church history. The church became legal in 313 under an edict that was issued jointly by Constantine and Licinius. They ruled the Roman Empire together from 313 to 324. And so in Milan in 313, they issued an edict that made Christianity legal. In fact, it made it the preferred religion. Constantine came to be a Christian. We don't know if he was or wasn't. The Lord knows those things. He put off his baptism until the day of his death because he didn't want to sin after he was baptized. You can see the difficulty with that. Being baptized on the day of your death and come out of the water complaining about it being too cold. You can see that there is virtually no way you can prevent sinning after baptism, even if baptism came with your last gasp. But that was the way he felt. So we really don't know much about him. He's an interesting person, and I shan't say more about him. Licinius was a total pagan. But Licinius felt that the larger portion of his empire, the Eastern Roman Empire, was made up of Christians. Christianity had become almost the major party. And so he felt that it was only right they have freedom, and so he and Constantine made Christianity legal in 313. Now from there on, for the next 1,200 years, the big quest of the church will be for the legal and the favor of the emperors and the rulers of the kingdoms. And in time, of course, the church will try to run them. But the big quest will be for imperial favor, because now you're the favored child. And rather than the blood of martyrs being the seed of the church, you'll soon have the church martyring within itself people that really stand up strong for the gospel. The big quest will be for material acceptance and for imperial favor and for power, particularly with men, not so much with God. There will be a lot of doctrinal issues discussed in this period. The doctrine of the Lord's deity was pretty well settled in the Council of Nicaea. I will say more about that in a little while. But here you have a period from about 300 A.D. to about 500 A.D., which is full of very intense doctrinal studies. And now men have the time and freedom to do it openly. They're legal. So you can have a library. They could build a giant one at Alexandria. You can have a library. You can have books. You can consult. You can have all kinds of meetings. Not that they didn't have some before, but beforehand, if they had a big meeting of Christian leaders like you've got here, it was just a nice place to arrest a lot of guys all at once. And so they were limited in what they could do and limited in the freedom of their actions. Many times they weren't arrested, but there was always that threat. And then there came the collapse of the Western, shouldn't say church. And in my notes it says collapse of the Western church. Somebody must have got in a typewriter and hit the keys. Should be the collapse of the Western government. Doesn't even sound like church. Well, that happened sometimes. 476, when the barbarians overran Rome. Barbarians are people that don't know how to hold their teacup properly. So they, and you know, don't make tea in a pot, make it in a cup, one cup at a time. That is the height of barbarianism. But the barbarians overran the Roman Empire in 476. Don't imagine it happened in one day. They've been overrunning it for 100 years. They've been falling and crumbling. Finally, by 476, the Western government collapsed completely. The Western church did not collapse. The Western church, and particularly the church at Rome, was the one thing that survived. And it survived because they had some very capable leaders. What they were spiritually is a matter I can't always know, but they were capable men. Here's Leo the Great. Here's Leo the Great going out to meet Attila the Hun. You must know that story. Leo is the head of the Roman church. You wouldn't have worn the same kind of fancy clothes he wore, but that's what he wore. And he goes out to meet Attila the Hun, who's about to sack Rome, kill the people, take the riches, do all of those things. What Leo said to him that night, nobody knows. But the next morning, Attila's men picked up stakes and left without touching the city. A few years later, the Vandals are about to sack Rome. Leo goes out again. The Vandals do not leave. They go in the city and steal a lot of stuff, but don't burn, loot, and pillage like they normally did. And following him, there are a number of other men like that who are striking leaders within the Roman church. And so the Roman church rises as a symbol of something that can survive the collapse of society. The Roman Catholic organization, as we knew it when we were young. I'm smiling. There have been drastic changes in the Roman Catholic Church since Vatican II. they have not been for the better. Some places they've worked for the better because God knows how to confuse the foe. But in the totality of what it's doing, don't be deceived on that. Rome is still a no, well, et cetera, a no gospel-oriented society. It's hard to say it just right, so if that offends you, see me later, and I'll try to say it more accurately. The guys that talk off the top of their head often say things crudely. But the Roman system still does not present a saving message to mankind. That's what it boils down to. And that doesn't mean you won't meet some that aren't saved. The Lord has saved people in the strangest kind of places. It doesn't mean you might not run into some priest that knows some great truth. There have always been some. Some of the great religious works of all time were written by men in the system who still had a true knowledge of Jesus Christ. But the system not only does not present the gospel, but now fabricates a presentation, which is harder to work with than the older system as I see it. You're not obligated to see things as I do. You don't even have the right kind of glasses. But as I see it, it moves along that way. But the mere survival of the Roman church system was really big news and gave it tremendous prestige. In 1054, there would be a great division between the Greek churches and the Roman church. They'd been arguing for years. The Greek church argued. They'd argued over a lot of things. But the final blow came. The Roman church argued that the Holy Spirit came to us from the Father and the Son. And the Greek church argued that he came only from the Father. The key term in church history is filioque, the Latin term meaning and the Son. And so they had a big furor. Finally, in 1054, they blew up. They denounced each other. They condemned all of each other's saints to hell and announced that none of them were true Christians. And suddenly the world had no, you can get the feeling for that. And the division of 1054 has not been healed to this day. This was the age when the church, by the 12th century, began to develop the scholastic movement, began to study things more carefully, and also became into the danger of baptizing fellows like Aristotle and whatnot and making Christian theologians out of them. The scholastic move. The scholastic move had both good and bad sides to it, but it came towards the end of the Middle Ages as a rebirth of an interest in study and writing. It was the age in which the church, Roman church, was moved from Rome in 1307 to 1370, roughly, 74, moved from Rome over to France. All the popes had to live in France for a period of about 70 years. Great strife and great grief. At one time, as many as three men claiming to be Bishop of Rome all at the same time. Eventually, that was ended in 1416 by the Council of Constance, which also secured the burning of John Huss. This is the age in which Huss and Wycliffe come to light at the end of it as real gospel preachers in their own right. And, of course, it's the age of the Waldensians, a very evangelical movement, which reached out to touch many people with a true saving message. There's obviously too much in it to give you a full-scale development. There's obviously too much. But it's the Middle Ages. The church moves from being legal to being massive to being demanding. It moves from being a suffering community to being a martyring community. So the group that was ready to die in 300 AD, by 1400 AD, is killing people who oppose it. It's fast, amazing how fast the legalization of Christianity accomplished things. By 370 A.D., see the church is legal in 313, by 370 A.D., it was a capital offense to be converted to Judaism in the Roman Empire. Now, if you were a Jew, you could stay one. But if you were not a Jew, to be converted was a capital offense. That doesn't mean they caught them all, but that was a capital offense. By 380, you couldn't be a member of the government unless you were a Christian, quote, an end Christian. So you get the feeling that the church ballooned rather quickly. And all sorts of funny birds came to dwell in it, not to its great help. Well, I've had people say that the great problem was they should have never been legalized. That's always people that are living a nice life that say that. People who drive a nice car and are well accepted, they say the church should have never been legalized. People that are dying in persecution generally don't feel that way. So it's kind of pointless to argue it backwards today. It happened. It happened in accord with the will and the sovereignty of God. If God had not so designated it, it would not have occurred that way. So it came to pass. In this age are the great councils. I mentioned them on page 6. The Council of Nicaea gave the definitive statements on Christ's deity and on the Trinity. The Council of Constantinople gave the definitive statement on the fact that Christ was a true human person as well as God. And the Council of Chalcedon gave the definitive statement that Christ should be understood as being perfect man and perfect God at the same time, but the perfect man not being bothered by the perfect God and the perfect God not being weakened by the perfect man. Complicated issues. When we say they gave the definitive statement, what we mean is they studied, worked, and formulated an idea which the church of its time accepted. Doesn't mean you can't restudy it later, but it's hard to find anything more to your heart than the Nicene Creed and the Constantinople Creed. The Chalcedonian Creed gets a little rambling and you hardly know where they are sometimes, but they formed the definitive statements that mark the church. As I mentioned earlier, there were some schisms with the Novatians and Donatists. There's the conquest of Leo the Great and Attila the Hun. And then around 600 AD, there's a very famous pope. Pope is not really legally used yet. We're using it anachronistically. There's a famous leader in Rome, Gregory the First, who institutes for the first time, really. I guess I can take a moment of history on this. After the Western Empire fell, the city of Rome survived, and the Church of Rome survived. They soon got political help from the Ostrogoths. Don't write it down, just believe me. From the Ostrogoths. For about 50 years, the Ostrogoths protected them politically from warfaring nations. Then the Ostrogothic king lost his power, and the emperor of the Eastern Empire, Justinian was his name, he took Rome under his wing and under the wing of the Eastern Empire for about 100 years. And then he lost his power. And suddenly here was the city of Rome with a couple million people and barbarian hordes to the south and barbarian hordes to the north, and this group would run up and snatch something and that group would run up and snatch something. The new leader in Rome said, we can't have this kind of nonsense. And so he was Gregory the Great. He organized an army. He's a very pious fellow in some ways. He's the author of many of the Gregorian chants. I kind of hate chants, but he's the author of many of them. So he organized an army. And from time to time, he could lead divine service and take a sword and go lead him if necessary. And he beat off barbarians to the south and beat off barbarians to the north, and more than any other one man, established the community of Rome, which would later become a national state, which it is through much of this period, a political temporal power. Gregory the Great is an interesting fellow. He's responsible for about 90% of the Mariolatry in the Roman Church. Used to be a sign that the Knights of Columbus read, put in magazines, and they talked about the eternal nature of the truths in the Roman Church, how they'd had these truths and kept them all those years. Now, the first thing you discover in doctrinal studies is that the Roman Church in 300 A.D., the church that met at Rome, was as different from the one that met there at 600 as it was from the one there that met 900, 1200, and so forth. And most of the doctrines that you and I think of as being identified with Rome developed well after 550 A.D., well after that, and crept in slowly up to the present. That doesn't mean nobody thought them before that, but they crept in slowly up to the more present time. When a few years ago they announced that Mary had been taken bodily up into heaven on her demise, if you could call it that, now that had been whispered in the church for years. That's in my lifetime, but the official proclamation, see, has come only recently, and up to the official time of that proclamation, you could believe it or not believe it. So there is no structure to Rome which looks back and says, we've always been what we were. They, like everything else, have been filled with change and difficulties and corruptions. In this period, the Holy Roman Empire develops, in which the leading emperor of the world would assume to take protection for the church. It meant that every church leader in the world courted his opinion. Some tried to govern him, and he tried to govern another. But the great development was the development of power, papal power, as the Vatican, let's say Rome, as Rome became a temporal state, and the Vatican became the capital of that temporal state. If you like to read, there's an interesting book. I never remember the titles well. But one of the more authors I enjoy more in the present is a fellow named Malachi Martin. He is an ex-Jesuit. I don't know that he's been converted. He's just out of the system. And Martin writes a book entitled The Rise and Fall, The Fall of the Roman Papacy. Back in this period, Martin says, is when the whole thing began to fall apart, as the individual monarchs wanted temporal power and would sacrifice anything to get it. So he said, the curse of our church was its desire for power and control of others. Well, what we're talking about is not just these little historical ramifications, but the concept of what happened when the church was preoccupied with worldly things. And now let me note those for you more formally on pages 6 and 7. I've broken the total period into three segments, which are not mutually exclusive and jointly exhaustive, but three segments for easier consideration. The first of those I've called the Imperial Age, from 313 to 476, while there was still an emperor in Rome and still an emperor in Constantinople. In that period, the preoccupations with popularity, prestige, and worldly success. Popularity. Having the applause of the people and the nations and the rulers. Prestige. Wearing the better robes. Leading the big procession. Being known for greatness. And worldly success. The building of buildings and monuments and things to its past. Those things are somewhat true in other ages too. But this was the first time the church had a chance. It had not been popular before. But now popularity becomes a great quest. And the first thing you do in courting popularity is to drop your standards so that everybody can be what you want them to be. And the second thing you do is to drop your message. Not everybody doesn't do those things, but to a large extent it happened unbelievably fast. So that in this period, men who stand for the truth of the gospel begin to be rarer and rarer and rarer. And formalists and monks and monastics begin to be more and more popular. So here's Simeon Stylites on his pillar. Was it 60 feet high? I never worry much about details, but here he's on his pillar. It's only 6 feet square on the top. He's going to spend 20 years up there. He's not the only guy that did it. There were lots of guys that did things like that. My students always look and say, up in a little thing like that for 20 years? Yes. They say, where did he brush his teeth? The answer is he didn't. He didn't have to worry about halitosis. Nobody was there. But you see, the big thing is to make yourself look good. People pass by and they say, a holy man is up on the pillar. I'm always suspicious of guys that sit on pillars. I never thought that any of them were holy. But the idea is that they set themselves apart for God, and the church will soon find all sorts of bizarre ways to do that. The monastic orders multiply. Some of them are good and decent. I'm not saying they're not. But they multiply and abound as the church finds ways to make itself popular and to make it popular to be part of the system. And what you lose are your standards and your message. Now, there will be people who keep the message, but they will stand out like a sore thumb as the years go on. And, of course, we know the Lord always has his own. No doubt over in a corner somewhere were about six fellows with a zither singing, Jesus Loves Me. No doubt somewhere they were, but we don't know where they were and don't know who they were. Now just pause and swallow hard on this. You look like a fairly friendly group. Don't worry about tracing your roots back to ancestors. You know, don't worry about tracing them back to apostolic times. It is a fruitless search. You can trace yourself all the way back to Adam if you want. But in terms of ecclesiastical succession, just give it up right now. The Lord knows his own. Let them depart from iniquity. People say, well, there must have been some of our people around in those years. Oh, there probably were. But you don't have any idea who they were, where they were, or what they were doing. So you pick up a book like Augustine. You may not like all that Augustine says, but you pick up his confessions and read about the purity of his conversion and his joy in God, and your heart hits a note and you say, praise the Lord. And you find out with a few others. You pick up a few other guys, you say, what are they doing? But the church moves in a popular quest and begins to build that popularity by more processions, more holidays, more big feasts, more things to make itself look good in the mind of the people. Now, as that goes on, church leaders look for more support from the national rulers. They will do anything for the favor of an emperor. In the next period, they will try to run him, but right now, they'll do almost anything for the favor of an emperor. And some will compromise standards or whatever it takes. But here's what I said a moment ago, repeated. When you become preoccupied with popularity, prestige, worldly success, the things you give up are your standards and your message. Now, if we make standards that are ridiculous, maybe we ought to give them up. But if we keep biblical standards in the forefront, they should never be forsaken. And consequently, when we look for popularity, we start to give those things up. I shan't bring out any more whipping boys, but, you know, I wasn't raised in the fellowship of whatever you call it. I trusted the Lord in a little denominational church in western Pennsylvania where a fellow was preaching the gospel just for a little bit, and a number of us were saved, for which we thank God. I kind of watched as a youth the collapse of the denomination. I fled from it in due time. They didn't even care. I fled from it in due time, and while headed down to Jericho from Jerusalem, fell among the brethren. And what's written in my heart is that I don't want to see our fellowships collapse like that old group collapsed. No one person can do that. Vigilance is required by the community, but I haven't wanted to see it. And this quest for popularity is one of the surest ways to lose it. It doesn't have to, but it's one of the surest ways to lose it. So, you know, you really think that people who don't believe in Jesus are really going to hell. They're lost. But around you is a big, soft world that doesn't want anybody to take hard stands like that. And the next thing you know, you begin talking about conditional, probational salvation for those who may have been... The second part of this period is what we refer to as the Dark Ages, a tough time when the historians tell us that less than one-half of 1% of all the people... I'm sorry, less than one-tenth of 1% of all the people in the world could read or write. I urge people who like to read the histories of Will Durant through this period. He's maybe not the greatest historian. He's far better one than I am, but may not be the greatest, but he and his wife were super writers. So in this particular period, it'll give you something. Any night you can't sleep, they will help, but it will give you something big in the histories of Will Durant. But the Dark Ages were a time when morality almost disappeared. You have to go back and read Chaucer and see in Chaucer what they saw the priests and the people that served the church. Morality almost disappeared. What the church was preoccupied with was survival for itself as a political state and authority over the kings and nations. And to get that, you will compromise your very soul. Survival of itself, not as a godly remnant. God will take care of that. But survival of itself as a worldly state with the temporal power over emperors and kings, so that you say this and they do it. I fear the church being preoccupied with that. There are so many things that I don't know for a fact, and fellows who speak shouldn't speculate too much. But I fear the circumstance where somebody says, all we Christians get together and tell the government to do what we think it ought to do. Most of us can hardly do what we ought to do in our fellowships. But if you feel contrary to that, I don't mean to browbeat anybody, but I fear it. I fear the quest for temporal power, because it almost always is bought at the expense of your integrity. And in the long run, that's the expense of truth. It is much too high a price to pay. So here is the King of France. King of France, the year is, let's say, 750 A.D. for a nice round number. Here's the King of France. He's trying to unite a throne which for two centuries has been divided, not wickedly divided, but just divided between the Merovingian and Carolingian kings. How can he unite the throne in a way that everybody will be happy? Well, to him, the obvious answer is to have the man at Rome, who is the best known clergy of the Western world, recognize him as King of France. And so he says to the Bishop of Rome, he says, if you will recognize me as King of France, I will send an army over and triple your territories in Italy. I'm not sure he said triple, but considerably add to them. Now, that particular bishop didn't live long enough, but the next one saw a bargain when he knew it. And so he crowned Pepin the King of France, and Pepin recognized him as the spiritual head of the Western world. It wasn't the first time it happened. But after that, see, the religious leaders in Rome say, oh, ho, ho, they depend on us to make them king. We will make them sweat a little blood over that. And so they will look at rulers and they say, you really want to be king? How much is it worth to you? And after a while, the king will get into that act too, and some leader will die in a church, a bishop, an archbishop, or somebody, and the king will say, you want to be the next bishop? What will you pay? And before long, you're up to the time of Luther, when a bishopric in England sold for the equivalent today of $75,000 and present modern inflated money. But in that day, a gigantic sum, as the church was preoccupied with worldly things. Note in themselves, they don't seem so bad, popular prestige, survival and authority. The problem is what you sacrifice to get those things. And so morality was almost a lost cause. The late Middle Ages period, they were preoccupied with political power and earthly possessions. Here's the age of the Renaissance and the building of great cathedrals. Now that will continue for a while. I never understood that. I never understood how a church in the middle of an impoverished territory where people were starving could erect itself a giant thing enameled with gold and silver. I never could understand it. But lately I've done a lot of reading in that study, and I now understand it. They justified it on the grounds that since the doctrines they taught were beautiful, the external structures ought to adorn them. So the external beauty was thought as a credit to the internal beauty, and they really piled it on. Raised thousands and millions. They raised a lot of it by selling people papers that let them get their grandmother out of hell. Purgatory was easier. Hell was tough. But if you had enough, anything might be accomplished. We look back and say, that's a lot of rot. Yes, it no doubt was that. And men like Wycliffe and men like Huss and men like Peter Waldo and others saw it like that and stepped out to preach the gospel and to denounce these things. Huss paid for it with his life. Wycliffe died first, but 20 years after he died, they dug him up, tried him, found him guilty, and hung him and burned him. But we understand it didn't bother him much at the time. Peter Waldo's movement spread throughout throughout Italy and Savoy. It was a two-by-two, door-by-door movement. You wouldn't have been happy with everything Waldo did, but for 95% of what he did and taught, you would have been mighty pleased. And Peter Waldo himself was one of those guys, since they didn't wear any special clothes and just looked like the rest of us, nobody knew where they were. He was always, we say humorously, 1 hour ahead of the posse. He was always just a jump ahead of the thugs that sought his life in the course of it. I'm not saying that Huss and Wycliffe and Waldo were angelic, but they suddenly realized that the church in its quest for power and earthly possessions had given up the gospel. The gospel had been encrusted with those things that brought it more money. All right, in our fellowships, we take an offering on the Lord's Day at the breaking of bread. In Curly Hill, that's all we take. If anybody dreams of taking it any other time, I'm sorry. If a brother comes by that's serving the Lord and speaks on Wednesday night, we'll take up an offering for him on Wednesday night. So you have to understand, I see how we think we're purer than we are. But anyhow, that's all we do. We take up this offering after the breaking of bread on the Lord's Day. We don't run around and fight with the people that take up an offering every time six people sit down in the church. That's just what we do. We take it up. And every now and then the brethren sit down and look at it and they say, it's not very much. We've been blessed with a lot of souls that love us and love the Lord's work. But every now and then we say that. They actually got to the point where they asked me to give a message on giving. I'm not the guy to ask to give those kind of, but they thought it'd be nice if somebody gave a message on giving. Why don't we speak on it more? Well, it's because, I don't know. Never mind. But I did anyhow, and it's really dumb to say it. I hadn't done a message on giving in 25 years in the chapel, I'll guarantee it. And still I felt like maybe people would think we talked about it all the time. It's an amazing thing. But see, in the Middle Ages, with this desire for possessions, you couldn't wait for people to bring it in, so you taxed everybody in the congregation. The priest showed up, or whatever you want to call him, showed up and said to you, it looks like you could afford $100. You looked and said, but I only make $110. He said, well, would you sooner pay it, or shall we send the soldiers to get it? And so in the quest for adorning themselves, they became corrupt beyond belief to the selling of men's souls and the taking of men's lives. And wherever a group objected, now some of the groups that objected were not good too, but wherever a group objected, there was a quick move of persecution. Although we're not totally happy with Francis of Assisi, the Roman Church was enormously suspicious of him. Enormously suspicious because he preached poverty and doing away with worldly riches. His own followers soon discovered that it was better to have two cars than a donkey, and so his order, a few years after he was dead, was richer than he could have ever imagined, dreamed, or thought of. He would have hated it. They'll go through a lot of struggles. But you see, the church is preoccupied with worldly things. And what does it do? When it's preoccupied with worldly things, it loses its standard and loses its message. When it's preoccupied with worldly things, it sacrifices what it might have to give to the world otherwise, including its morality and example. When it's preoccupied with worldly things, it loses its own integrity and identity. It happens real fast. But note that most of the things we call worldly So we only call them worldly because they are not biblically ordered things. And the church goes into them very easily. I think it's good to have a nice building. I think it's silly to plate it with gold. Well, maybe it's silly to plate it with bricks. Maybe aluminum siding would be all right. Maybe clapboard. Maybe asphalt shingles that are being thrown off the school buildings because they cause cancer. Maybe mud wickets. I was down in Brazil for a few days in January. Just like you to know that I'm a world traveler, too. Went down to see relatives of ours in Brazil. I don't know where to Portuguese, so don't try me on that. But went to see relatives of ours who served the Lord a long time there with a little Baptist work in Ceará in the town of Fortaleza, in and around there. They took me out on Sunday night to a church where they asked me if I would preach. My brother-in-law would he would put it in Portuguese for me. It was not about this size auditorium. It was mobbed with people. They sang with a vengeance. The bricks were made, the walls were made largely out of a mud brick type of construction, not like adobe, but it was quite nice, And they were getting ready to build a big addition to it, which one of the men told me would seat 600 people. He said, we have about 300 in here, but this was all translated for me. And so we looked around where the big addition is being built. The walls are up and other things are being up, and the walls look just like the walls in the old one. And one of these fellows said to me, through the translator, are you with me on that? He said, some thought we ought to use better stones. But he said, I said, why use better ones when these do? The only reason you'd use better ones when these do is you want to look better. And it certainly isn't wrong to look better, but when that becomes the goal of your work, it is bad news. I used to threaten to teach a course in the seminary in landscaping. I worked it out. I said, we'll give a course in pastoral landscaping so that the lawn of every fundamental church will look nicer than those of the liberal churches up and down the street. And I used to have fellows ask me when it would be given and when could they sign up. Just note these grim ultimate consequences of preoccupation. Note them rapidly. They're scheduled on page 7. The judgment and character of truth is blunted. Biblical values are lost. Principles give way to expediency. You'll do anything to get 6 more kids in Sunday school. Bribe them, coax them, kidnap them. Maybe even adopt them if necessary. Although that might have some permanent value, but expediency often triumphs over principles. Methods, when I say unbiblical, some fellows say it's got to be mentioned in the Bible to be biblical. What I'm saying here is principles and practices that the Bible would condemn easily become the expression of the life of the company. Artificial means are relied upon to supply biblical life, and the redemptive preaching is virtually abandoned. And yet, as I mentioned on page 8, you can have a great building. You can even have a great congregation. There's a giant one in California. Do I have to tell you where it is? A giant one, beautiful, big, and enormous. But the mere factor of size is no proof of divine blessing. And the mere factor of beauty is no proof that you're serving God. Those things have to be remembered. We don't want to go to the other extreme either and say, well, if we've got more than 6 people, it must be apostate. And we've got to always meet in a former school bus waiting shed. We don't want to go to the other extreme either. In the middle of those things, we want to keep our values set upon Christ and obedience to His Word and fellowship, the things that make for oneness, while on the other hand, being very careful not to set our minds on worldly attainments. Every brother and his work, every meeting and its consistency has to search itself in those lines. And I don't say that it's easy. But not to do it is to lose the very thing you hope to give.